And welcome back to Insemination. My name is Laura High, and I am your sperm donor baby of the podcast world, and I have got such an amazing episode for you. I have been absolutely dying to share this episode. I am so excited to welcome on Dina DNA, a phenomenal genetic counselor who's going to teach all of us about how genetic testing works. This is so important for all of us to understand. But before we get into the episode, I have some exciting news that I finally get to share. As many of you know, I have been funding for an upcoming donor-conceived event, and I am ready to announce it. On October 15th, we will be having the very first protest for donor-conceived rights in New Orleans. We will be protesting there because ASRM, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, will be holding their annual conference in New Orleans at the Convention Center, and we are going to be there as well. ASRM, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, is the group that creates the guidelines for the clinics and cryobanks to follow. This event is arguably the biggest event in the fertility industry in the United States and arguably globally. This convention circles around donor conception, and yet again, for another year in a row, ASRM has not invited a single donor-conceived person to speak on any of the panels. ASRM has also shown an apathy to donor-conceived causes, which is absolutely ludicrous because we should be their first priority. And since they refuse to give us a seat at the table, we will be there to remind them that we are the table. They cannot have a conversation that is ethical without us. So October 15th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., we will be protesting. We will gather at the corner of Convention Center Boulevard and Julia Street in New Orleans. We will have a peaceful protest and make our voices heard. To get all the details and to understand the code of conduct that we must follow, please go to my website, www.laurahighfive.com. The five is spelled out. And then click the tab that says protest. Please read everything, and at the bottom there is a sign up for the protest. Please do that so we can ensure that we can keep everybody up to date. And also, October 15th at 8 p.m. that very same day, I will be headlining in New Orleans at the Howling Wolf. Because after we protest, oh boy, are we gonna need a laugh. Tickets are also available on my website. Seating is limited, so please get your ticket now. And please know that this protest is open for everybody to come. Donor-conceived people, recipient parents, donors, and allies. We must show solidarity in numbers. We need as many people as possible to show up, because we need to show them how many people care about this issue. I cannot wait to see you there, and more updates are following. Please follow me on social media at Laura High Five to stay up to date on everything. But now, let's get to the episode. And welcome to the podcast, Dina DNA, or more professionally known, Dina Goldberg. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited for you to be here because you are going to be, I think, resolving so much misinformation that we have about genetic testing.
I'm happy to do that.
I will be honest, like when I started my journey about learning about donor conception, I didn't realize how much I didn't understand about genetic testing. And the more I advocate, it's more apparent that no one knows how genetic testing works and what it is. So I'd love to spend this kind of first chunk of the episode kind of just asking you some basic questions about it so we all can get on the same page and we can walk away from this podcast super educated, because I feel like that's the most important thing.
Yes, absolutely. Let's do it.
Amazing. Well, for how long have you been a genetic counselor?
Let's see. I got my master's in 2015. So how many years is that? Five, six, seven years? No, 8 years. Yeah.
It can't 8 years. Be 8 years ago. It was 2015 yesterday. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
It can't be 8 years. My God. That's depressing.
Yeah. So I've been doing it a while. And before that, I have worked in genetics in other capacities. So I worked for laboratories. I started my career sequencing mitochondrial genomes of Native Americans in a molecular anthropology lab, which was awesome. Wow. And then I worked in a breast cancer research lab, actually doing hands-on work with cancer tissue, and then decided I didn't like the lab life and I wanted to see patients. And so that's when I went back to grad school to become a genetic counselor.
Now, is there a difference between a genetic counselor and a geneticist?
Great question. So geneticist is kind of loosely thrown around sometimes, but officially there's medical geneticists, there's lab geneticists, and then there's genetic counselors. And so all of their training is a little bit different. A medical geneticist is an MD who then goes on and does a fellowship in genetics. And usually they're pediatricians, or sometimes they're like OBs or something else, but they go on and they do that extra genetics training. And then usually those MD geneticists work in pediatrics and rare disease. So they work with patients who need hands-on physical examinations along with genetic testing usually. And then lab geneticists are a lot more based in a laboratory. They're the people that are going through your genetic code. They're doing research, they're interpreting, you know, all of that. And usually those are PhD geneticists. And then you have genetic counselors, which is a master's degree. And then you have to log a certain amount of hours and get a board certification. And we are the ones who work with patients in a lot of different settings, including pediatrics, the cancer setting, a lot of specialty settings. And in some cases, we see patients on our own. In some cases, we see patients alongside with an MD geneticist, depending on the clinic. So those are kind of the main differences between a geneticist, a lab geneticist, and a genetic counselor.
Amazing. Okay. That already clears a lot of stuff up for me, at least, because that was one thing that I was just like, I don't know the difference.
Confusing. And in other countries, they're called geneticists. The people that do what I do are called geneticists in other countries, and people like in research are called geneticists that have the same degree. So it's kind of confusing. But from the clinical side, with people who see patients, that's kind of how I like to think about it.
Okay. All right. So then let's start off with a nice simple foundational question. What is genetic testing?
Yes. Well, what a big question, right?
It is a big question, but I think we need to start off with, like, we're doing very serious do-re-mi right now.
Yes. So first of all, if the explanation that I'm about to give doesn't make sense, I do have a YouTube channel where I break down a lot of these things for people who are visual learners. So I have a lot of animations, and I think that you know,
I love that for me, that's all I would love that. So that's amazing.
Yeah. I myself am such a visual learner. So
me too.
Part of the reason I create this stuff is to help other people, because that's the way that I learned things.
Yeah.
But in just kind of describing it now, so genetic testing can mean a lot of different things, because there are a lot of ways to look at our genes. So our body's made up of lots of cells, and in every single cell in our body, we have our genetic code or our genetic material. And so the genetic material is basically the instructions that tell our cells what to do and how to function. And there are a lot of different ways to look at that genetic material. There's not just, you know, sequencing or just doing DNA testing, which a lot of people think, oh, it's easy, it's just DNA testing, but it's incredibly complex, because there are genes in different parts of the cells. There are different ways to look at the genes. There are mechanisms that control our genes. There's chromosomes, which are big packages of lots of different genes. And so depending on what we are looking for, there are different types of genetic tests that we would do. There's also, like in the cancer space, we can look at tumor genetics. And that's different from looking at germline genetics, which is the code that you're born with. So, and then there's, in the prenatal space, there's cell-free fetal DNA, which is the DNA from the fetus that's shed into the mother's bloodstream. So there's so many different types of genetic tests that it's really difficult to just define what genetic testing is as one thing, because it's basically any type of way to look at lots of different parts of kind of what tells our body, you know, the instructions that tell our body how to function.
Oh, what? No, that answered the question wonderfully. That was already that was really cool, actually. Like there was already so much in there that I was like, oh shit, I didn't know that. Well, look at there. So bouncing off of one of the things you said, what kinds of genetic testing can you do?
Yeah. So again, it depends on the reason for it. So let's see. I'm going to just kind of name a whole list of different reasons that people would do genetic testing. So One, a lot of people, so I come from, you know, the medical genetic testing side of genetic testing, but there's also genetic testing for things like ancestry, right? That's like a lot of the direct-to-consumer ancestry tests that can look at, you know, where your ancestors came from within a certain amount of generations. There is forensic genetic testing, which is looking, you know, used at crime scenes to try and solve crimes. But in the medical space, there are different, many different types of genetic tests. So there's tests that we do, like I was talking about earlier, on fetuses, right, on pregnant patients. So before, we think of those as kind of prenatal or fertility, that's kind of the beginning of life. And then there's tests we do when a baby's born and there's something, you know, clearly wrong and we're trying to figure out what it is. So there's different testing we do for that in the pediatric realm. There's testing that's done as, you know, throughout the life cycle when different medical issues come up. There's testing done to try and predict someone's risk, which is the preventative space, which is where I'm, you know, kind of sitting in. And then there's diagnostic testing to figure out why someone developed a disease already. And there's, you know, there's so many ways. I don't know if that answers the full question, but there are many different types of tests that we can do when we think about genetic testing.
It does. And I also think this kind of hits on, and I want to ask to see if I'm interpreting what you're saying, is there's not one genetic test where it tests you for like all of these things. You have to go in with a specific intention.
100%. That's 100% correct. Yes.
Okay. So when people tell me, when I'm like harping on about like, you know, donor conceived people deserve their medical history. And someone tells me like, well, just take a 23andMe test and you're fine. There's so much wrong about that statement.
Yeah, absolutely. 23andMe is a very, very, very small snippet that is not comprehensive and is not a medical grade test. I think it's great for ancestry. It really is, because that's the technology that is the gold standard for doing ancestry. It's called SNP testing. But it is not at all a medical test. It's not sequencing. It's not looking at every gene associated with certain conditions. And so that's only one type of test. And it really doesn't even cover a full, you know, comprehensive workup for any condition.
What about something?
Yeah, it is problematic. What?
What about something like Prometheus? I get asked about that a lot.
Oh, Prometheus. Prometheus. It's a third party software where you run your raw data through it, right?
Okay.
It's cool if you are somebody who really likes to learn about yourself, but there's a huge caveat there. So I have had many, many patients that have come in because Prometheus told them they had some sort of cancer syndrome or some, you know, really serious condition that they were at risk for. And I go to test them, and most of them are actually negative when we do genetic testing. And there was a big paper that came out when we look at cancer genes, that they found that the false positive rate for people that were coming in with positive Prometheus results was 40%.
Oh my God.
Crazy.
That's
right?
Huge.
So, and I can send you this paper. And there were other papers that there were also other labs that were kind of testing both, and they were finding the same thing.
Oh,
so
wow.
If you do Prometheus and something comes up, you have to get it medically confirmed before you make any decisions. Mm-hmm. It causes a lot of unnecessary anxiety, in my opinion. So I think it can be great for people that just kind of want to browse their, you know, raw data, but you have to understand that if something comes up positive, you need to get it confirmed. And you could still have something that doesn't show up on Prometheus. So because Prometheus is only reading the data from the chip that was used at the other, you know, at the lab that you're importing data from, that's not your complete sequence at all. It is just bookmarks along the genome. So you can have a really serious mutation that wasn't tested.
Okay.
And most people that do have a serious condition, it's not tested by most of these direct-to-consumer SNP tests. So Prometheus won't find it either because the technology just didn't look for it. So there's also a lot of false negatives too. So tons of false positives, tons of false negatives.
Okay.
So that's why, you know, medical grade testing is just so much stronger and more important to do. But yeah, medical grade testing isn't a general, just like look at the whole genome. So I think it's okay to do as long as you understand all of that.
So understanding again, it's correcting this kind of misinformation so that mm-hmm. we can go in and have like, we can have correct expectations.
Exactly. Exactly. So I don't tell people not to do it. I just tell them if you're going to do it, you really need to understand that this is not at all either comprehensive mm-hmm. or necessarily accurate. So it needs to be confirmed, anything that's found.
Now, one thing that I am told a lot is when I, as a donor-conceived person, am saying, you know, we need to have contact with our donors to get updated family medical, an updated family oral medical history from our donors. And I get mm-hmm. told all the time, like, you don't need that. Just go get your DNA tested. Is getting your DNA tested the same as an oral history passed down? Is it the exact same thing, or are they two separate things?
Yeah, they're definitely two separate things. Okay. So in my clinic, when I do...
I told all of you, Cameron.
Yes. So both of them are incredibly important. An oral family history, very important. However, we know that in many cases, it's either not there or it's incorrect. And there's a lot of reasons that that can be the case. One, because you're donor conceived. Two, you're adopted. Three, your family doesn't talk about it because of cultural reasons. You didn't get good medical, you know, family members didn't get good medical care, so they never would have gotten a diagnosis. There's so many reasons that people's family history may not be accurate. So we take that into account as genetic counselors, and we understand, you know, we can get what we can get, but that can't be the only piece of this pie. And that's why genetic testing is, you know, combined with an oral family history. But it is not in place of a family history. So it's, you know, they're complementary and they are two pieces of this puzzle when we're trying to find someone's risk.
Now, I love that
analogy.
When somebody
doesn't have a family history, I do think genetic testing can be really wonderful because you really don't have an indication to look for, but it's not a replacement for a family history.
So if I now, so then with that, anything that can be passed down genetically, can we test for everything that can be passed down genetically?
You mean at the same time?
No, just in general. Like, is there a test for everything that you can be passed down genetically?
So short answer, no.
Okay.
And part of that is because there's a lot of cases of diseases that run in families that we still don't know either. We don't think they're caused by a single gene condition. We can't detect the gene yet, or we haven't discovered the gene yet, or, you know, it's multifactorial. So it's a combination of genetics and environment together. And that's really hard to study. And really hard. You can't really do genetic testing for that at this point in time. So, I guess the short answer is no, we can't look for anything that's passed down, which is why family history is still important. A lot of times when somebody has a negative genetic test result, but they still have a strong family history, we still will tell them, you know, your risk is still elevated based on family history. So the genetic testing doesn't tell us the whole picture, mm-hmm. right? It only tells us some. Then again, someone can have no family history, but they have a genetic mutation. And then we know that they're at risk for, and you know what their risk might be. And if we have the family history, that might alter that risk assessment a little bit. But if we don't, we still have good information. So that's, again, they're both separate, you know, pieces of data that we use in risk assessment.
I mean, I feel like that's such a good way, the way that that they're complementary, that like ideally mm-hmm. having both for everybody, not just adoptees or donor conceived people, but having both sounds like is an incredible gift for everybody that could prevent probably a lot of stuff that would come to you later in life. And I love how you're talking about like risk assessment, because if you just have something pop up on your genetic history, but no one in your family has been diagnosed with it, or something that is passed down heavily through your family, but it's not in your genetic, it's not within your genetic testing, that affects risk assessment. I think that that's really fascinating, that how both of your oral family history and your genetic testing can play off of each other that way.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I think of them as multiple clues. Like if I'm trying to solve this puzzle, there are mm-hmm. multiple pieces of really important information that I put together when I can.
Amazing. Can we genetically test for mental illnesses that are genetic?
Right. Okay. This is one of the most common questions that people ask. So I want to, there's a whole area of genetic counseling called psychiatric genetic counseling that was kind of founded by Dr. Janine Austin and the team at UBC. And their kind of theory is that most mental illness is multifactorial. So it's a combination of the genes that predispose you to mental illness and environmental triggers and trauma and lifestyle and all these things that go together. And so there's very few cases where there's a single gene change or mutation that will cause mental illness. Mm-hmm. So what they've done is they've been able to look at someone's family history to use empiric risk, meaning they look at, you know, how many people in the family had mental illness, what kinds of mental illnesses, and then use that information to kind of calculate the likelihood that someone else in the family may develop it. But it's not, there's not really genetic testing for mental illness because there are so many factors that go into it.
Absolutely. I ask this because this is one of the issues that I think donor-conceived people really have a lot of problems with. Is because as we, you know, anyone who's struggled with mental illness understands that it is incredibly hard to diagnose. Like it's, and when you don't have that family medical history or an accurate donor profile, it can just, you get screwed over. Very famous case of that was with, I don't know if you heard about the Stephen Gunner case.
It sounds familiar, but remind me.
Stephen Gunner was diagnosed in his 20s with schizophrenia. Found out, and his donor was donated when he was about like a 19 years old. And then when his donor was in his 20s, was diagnosed with schizophrenia. The problem was both the donor and Steven were showing they basically had very parallel lives. And they both OD'd within like a couple of years of each other.
Wow.
It's a horrible case. And it's really, really sad. But they both started showing signs of mental illness both around the ages of 4 years old. They were both taken to psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists. Now, I know when the donor donated, he was not diagnosed yet. But he had been institutionalized when he was, I believe, 14, 15 years old. And it was based off of a massive episode. Like he had threatened his dad with a baseball bat. He had locked himself in his attic when the attic was like 120 degrees. Firefighters had to come rescue him. And he was institutionalized for a month. None of that was shown in the donor report. So there was no indication that the donor had any kind of mental illness. And so when the Gunners were taking their son in to like get diagnosed, see different therapists and psychiatrists, they kept asking, what is the family medical history? And they were like, there's nothing there. There's nothing there. The donor is perfectly healthy. If they had at least known that, like, yes, he was institutionalized. Yes, there was a massive episode. He may have actually gotten his schizophrenia diagnosis much earlier, gotten his treatment, his therapy, his medication, his support needs met much earlier. And it's just, it's a horrible case where it's like, this so did not have to happen. And the parents were actively trying, like they were doing everything they could. And it's, this is something that happens with donor conceived people all the time, whether it's depression, bipolar disorder, anxiety, schizophrenia. And this is so common with donor conceived people. So that's why I ask about mental illness, because It's not, and there are so many clinics and cryobanks that actively just don't report mental illness because they're like, because they just don't think that they need to.
Yeah, that's really tough. It's really tough because it's not something we can test or like say, looking at someone's genes, there's no black and white. Yes, this person will have schizophrenia. This person will not.
Yeah.
Clearly in that case, that donor had a lot of that genetic risk and so needed less of the kind of other inputs for that diagnosis to come out. because I'm not a psychiatric genetic counselor, I don't have as much probably to add, but
no, absolutely.
But I do like, I'll make the intro to Dr. Austin because I think that would be a phenomenal conversation.
I think for that particular case, that was the case that sort of sponsored the Donor Conceived Persons Protection Act, where it would require clinics and banks to verify the medical history that a donor hands in, because if they had known, if they had known that the donor had a, I for lack of better words, and if I'm using the wrong word, I apologize, but if they had known that he had that episode, that he had been institutionalized, that would have definitely been on the donor profile and could have indicated Stephen's doctors that there might be something genetically that is diagnosable. And it,
so it probably wouldn't be genetically, but it would be there was some hereditary risk factors.
Is there a difference between hereditary and genetic?
Great question. So actually, okay. So when we think about genetic, it just means anytime that there's a change or that there are, like the root cause of something is in the genetic code, but hereditary means runs in families. So you can have something that's genetic. That's
not
hereditary.
My God.
Mm-hmm.
So
for instance, you can have a new genetic mutation in a child that didn't exist in the parents. So it's not hereditary, but it's genetic, right?
Oh, and that cancer is
from different genetic changes in cells. But it's not, most of the time, it's not hereditary. So it's just something that happens over time as we age. So, so those are different. It's like square in a circle, you know, in the circle, that whole thing.
That is fascinating. Oh, my God. I would have, like, as soon as you said that, I'm like, oh, of course, that makes so much sense. But that was, thank you. That was incredibly useful.
Yeah.
Differentiation.
But actually, and now that I'm thinking of it, so you actually did say it right, because you said if the doctors had known there was some genetic risk, what I meant to say is there would be no way to detect it using a genetic test.
Yeah.
But it would probably be some genetic risk or some, you know, like the hereditary risk, the risk that's passed down from the donor to that child.
That is fantastic. Oh my gosh. So kind of going into, because I've now heard you sort of like mention this word a little bit, what do you mean by genetic markers?
Yeah. When I'm saying genetic markers, I say that because a lot of times people, like the public, latches onto that a little bit better than genetic changes or genetic mutations. But the way I'm using them is synonymous.
Okay. And another thing that you earlier brought up is a full genome sequencing test. What does that exactly mean? And how is that different than like other testing that you can do?
Sure. So when we think about how we look at our genes, there are different methodologies for testing. So in medical genetics, at least in, there's a lot of different ways in medical genetics, but in what I typically do, I'm usually ordering panels of genes, which means that they're like bundles of specific genes associated with a condition that we're looking for, right? Or that we're doing preventative testing for, or that we're doing diagnostic testing for. So let's say I'm talking about cancer genes, right? I can do a cancer panel that looks at all the genes associated with cancer that we know of, that we have good information on, good evidence on, but it's only targeting those genes, and they can be at all lots of different locations across the genome. And when we say genome, it just means your whole genetic code, your whole library of information in each of your cells. So different genes have different jobs, and we typically know which genes do which things, but we only really know the tip of the iceberg right now. There's a lot more genes we're still learning about. Okay. So when we do genetic testing panels, we're actually looking at very specific genes that have specific functions we know of at this point in time. And we're looking at them and reading through them many times. So there's something called coverage, which is the amount of times that the gene is read through to make sure that it is being read correctly, and that if there is a mutation or there is a variant, and we can get into that in a second, the difference, but that the variant is actually there. So you read it a certain number of times as high coverage. That's a panel. Now, okay. When we're doing something, then there's another test called whole exome sequencing. And that typically we do for people with an undiagnosed disease, where we're kind of fishing to try and figure out what's going on. Maybe they've already done a panel. It was negative, but we really believe there's something genetic. The exome consists of what are called exons in our genes. And that's basically what we feel is the important material or the important sections of genes that actually code for proteins. So I've heard people use the metaphor. It's like, if you're flipping through a magazine, you know, there's articles and advertisements. And if you were to just cut out all the articles, which is the substance of the magazine, that's like the exons. That's like the exome testing. So it's like only looking at the parts we believe are important and code for proteins. So that's whole exome sequencing. And then there's whole genome sequencing, which is looking at everything, even the parts of the genome that we don't believe are important or that are kind of between the important genes or the important segments of genes. And so that is a lot of information. And because every human is so different and everybody has a different genetic code, using the Human Genome Project and other databases that are out there, we kind of know, or scientists know, what codes are normal or what spellings of different genes or different sections are normal and what are not. But when you do whole genome sequencing, you're going to get tons of variants because tons of variations from what we believe are the normal reference sequence. And so it's this huge file. There's a lot of kind of interpretation that needs to be going into that. And when you do those tests, you kind of have to also know what you're looking for, because they may find, you know, hundreds of variants and they only want to maybe filter through the ones associated with the condition that in question and some of the variants in the genes that are important for that. So it's a huge test. It's casting the widest net, for at least when we're looking at nuclear DNA, which is the most of the genetic code in our nucleus.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover
inside the house there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
So so that's done. And I think that will be the future once we like learn more about it. But it is it's a lot more complex. Now, the downside to doing that is the technology that's used to sequence so much information means that usually there's less coverage of each of those important genes. And so if it doesn't cover a section that contains a gene that you have a mutation in, there's a possibility of missing something. So that's why we usually, like, a lot of times we'll start with a panel. And then if that's not, you know, positive, then we'll maybe go on to whole genome or whole exome. It just depends on the situation. But those are that's kind of the different types of testing, at least that the different levels right now. And then there's, of course, lots of other choices as well. But that's when we think about sequencing.
Okay.
These are three levels of it. Does that make sense?
It does. It's all fabulously complicated. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you actually covered it at my next question, which was perfect. This might be an impossible question to answer, especially as a scientist. But in terms of our understanding of how genetics work, what genetics are, how far are we into our understanding about genetics? Because, like, from what I understand is, like, it's still so baby and infantile.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Listen, there's a lot that we know and have learned and can do lots of wonderful things with, but there's a lot more we don't yet know.
Yeah.
So it is in its infancy. I think it's the tip of the iceberg, right? You know, that poster where like the tip and then there's a huge iceberg underneath. I think that's where we are, but
we haven't cut into that atom yet.
Yeah. Like it's We have a lot to go, but like I said, we also have a lot that we do know. And so, you know, a lot of people actually think that genetics is more in its infancy than it actually is. So, I think a lot of people don't realize that it is something that is standard of care in a lot of specialties and is covered by insurance and can be incredibly helpful.
Okay.
For the most part. Okay. Right. Like for the most part, there are situations where I still think it can be helpful and it's not covered by insurance. And I'm sure we'll get to that today because a lot of that is adoptees and donor conceived and like people without family history. But yeah, so there's a lot, there is a lot we can do. There are a lot of really great information we can get from it, but there's also a lot we don't know.
Yeah.
Which is why I think it will be dangerous once people start doing like embryo editing, because we don't really know what downstream effects that may cause. And also
Jeff Goldblum speech from Jurassic Park where he's just,
I haven't seen it, but
you've never seen Jurassic Park?
Probably like a long time ago. I don't know. It's been a while.
Okay. For everybody who gets that reference, I like you. I just want you to know that.
I'm embarrassed. I don't know that.
Oh, it's fabulous. And it's all, it's genetic editing and just kind of, basically going, you know, you play God and this is what fucking happens. It's a great, great speech by Jeff Goldblum.
Okay. I'll have to watch. I'll put it on my list.
I know. Absolutely. One fun thing that I find very fascinating is there are different ancestral communities, groups where different genetic illnesses or genetic mutations run higher. Mm-hmm. And that's really common. And I find that to be very fascinating. And I would love, and I think that this is also, again, very important for donor-conceived people and adoptees, because a lot of us are either not told what our ancestry is or we're given the wrong ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
And it can actually very much not just affect our own, you know, personal identity, but it can also really affect
health history.
Yeah. What are some different genetic illnesses that can run in different ancestral groups?
Yeah. Great question. So traditionally, you know, what we knew for a long time was that, for instance, like cystic fibrosis was very common in people of European ancestry. People, Tay-Sachs, really well known in the Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry group. And then like sickle cell in ancestry groups from Africa and the Mediterranean. But honestly, there's so many of these different conditions that are from so many different ancestry groups. And there's a lot of like kind of crossover too. So for instance, people used to assume Tay-Sachs was only in Ashkenazi Jews, but it's actually found in French Canadians and in Cajuns and, you know, in different ancestry groups besides that. So, and then when you have any ancestry group where you've had kind of a smaller gene pool for a longer amount of time, you're going to have more of these genetic mutations that kind of are incubated within that gene pool or are passed and shared within that gene pool. So it's not just those ancestries I mentioned. Really, every ancestry will have conditions. And so we've kind of moved away from doing ethnicity-based screening to doing pan-ethnic screening. So what we're talking, when we think about kind of a lot of these conditions, we're thinking about people who are carriers for recessive conditions, which is when you have two copies of every gene and one of them doesn't work right and the other one does. If you are a carrier, then you usually don't show any signs of disease for the most part. If you marry or you have a child with, or, you know, use a sperm or egg from somebody who carries a mutation in the same gene, you can both pass down that abnormal copy. And if the child then inherits two abnormal copies, they can have a very severe disease. And so because carriers don't typically have symptoms, it can go through many generations without people knowing that they carry it until one day, you know, there's a baby that gets born with this awful disease. So those are recessive diseases. So when we think about anybody who's planning a pregnancy at any point, we recommend carrier screening. And really right now, the best thing to do is expanded carrier screening, which is looking at more than just whatever your self-reported ancestry group is.
Okay.
And so I'm a big advocate. Everyone kind of feels a little bit differently about it, but personally, there are so many reasons that people may not know their genetic ancestry, or that somebody's genetic ancestry may, you know, there may be a condition that's less common in that ancestry, but it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So I think it's so important to do a large carrier screening panel for everybody, regardless of what their known ancestry is. Even if you come from one of those groups where there are high prevalence of a certain condition, I just think everybody should get this, you know, the same big panel. And there's a lot of studies showing that people's self-reported ancestry is often incorrect when they do a genetic test, or when the laboratories on the back end, you know, do research and run their actual ancestry. So self-reported ancestry is wrong, whether you know your family history or not. It's very common to be wrong. So that's why, you know, I think that to make healthcare and genetics more equitable, we need to be doing larger panels that include genes from every ancestry group, just to make sure everybody's getting even testing.
That makes sense to me. And I think I would love to have this more available, because it does sound like, this actually leads perfectly into my next question. It sounds like the amount of preventative care that we could get from this could be, I mean, save so many lives. So mm-hmm. with that, and this is then goes into my next question of, again, I'm talking to the trolls in my comment section right now. I've had a lot of people saying, trying to phrase this correctly. I've had a lot of people saying, are there inheritable genetic illnesses, mutations, that if knowing about them ahead of time could provide life-saving, life-altering treatments?
Mm-hmm.
What would be those things that you could test for, that could literally save somebody's life?
Literally everything I test for.
There we go. Okay. Yeah.
So any hereditary cancer syndrome that's caused by a single gene mutation that runs in families, pretty much any of them are what we consider clinically actionable, meaning that there are actions to take to lower someone's risk. And so we use that information for personalized medicine. That's true in cancer. It's true in cardio care, so cardiology, ophthalmology, kidney disease. It's true in rare disease. It's true pretty much in any time there is a single gene genetic disorder. There are multiple benefits to knowing what that gene mutation is and who in the family has it, because almost everything we test for is clinically actionable. The exception to this is some of the neurological conditions. So for instance, knowing that somebody has a risk for early onset Alzheimer's, we may not be able to change anything to lower the risk. There may be lifestyle, you know, recommendations that could, but a lot of times those people, it's really helpful because then they can actually plan out their lives. They can make informed decisions for things. They can do IVF and select embryos that are not affected with that mutation and ensure that it doesn't get passed down. So there's a lot of benefits in preventing diseases for any time somebody is found to have a single gene disorder that puts you at risk for disease.
So let's hypothetically say, let's pick a kind of, I would say a basic is like, let's say the BRCA gene.
Mm-hmm.
Which would relate to breast cancer. If hypothetically, like, you know, you test me when we find out, like, okay, Laura, you have the BRCA gene, what would then probably happen afterwards? What are things that I can do with that information?
Sure. So every gene has its own set of guidelines, depending on somebody, you know, what mutation is there. And then we do look at personal and family history at someone's age and all that when we can. But so BRCA is associated, both BRCA 1 and 2 are associated with breast, ovarian, pancreatic, prostate, and melanoma. So it's important for both men and women. But the risk for females assigned at birth are is much higher than males assigned at birth, right? So the what that would look like is if you did have that mutation, and by the way, I should say it is 10 times more common in people with Ashkenazi ancestry.
Oh, that would be me.
Right, right. Yeah, that's so it's good you bring that one up because that's one of the ones that is really important in people with Ashkenazi, especially with Ashkenazi ancestry, that's outside a carrier screening. It is not on a carrier screening panel. It is not on a prenatal panel. This is on a cancer panel. And one in 40 Ashkenazi Jews or people with Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry carries a BRCA mutation. So there's a lot of experts that agree that everyone with Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry should be offered testing for at least the three founder mutations that are found in that group. But that being said, there's still a high risk in other populations as well. So we know now that in the Black community, it's actually higher than in people with European descent. And so there's the BRCA a movement gene? To try and get that more people tested because of some of the studies there that it kind of looks like it's in between the people of European descent and Ashkenazi Jewish risk. So honestly, I think eventually one day we're going to get to a point where everybody gets offered this testing earlier in life. So you understand your risk. We're just not there yet.
It just sounds like anybody who's AFAB should get tested for the BRCA gene. That just sounds like.
Just not even AFAB. Anyone.
Anyone.
Because it's important for males assigned to birth as well.
Yeah, that just sounds, the more you talk about it, the more it's like, yeah, everybody should be getting this done.
But it's not, and then here's the thing, it's not just BRCA, there are other cancer genes. In fact, Lynch syndrome is a hereditary cancer syndrome that's more common than BRCA. And people just don't talk about it because there was no Angelina Jolie that came out with Lynch syndrome. So that one is associated with increased risk for colon cancer as well as uterine cancer. Those are the highest. And then ovarian, a lot of different GI cancers and a number of other cancers. But a lot of them are preventable if we know that information early and there's a lot of screening we can do. So that's another example of one of these hereditary syndromes. And again, and most people, by the way, with Lynch syndrome that have it, don't know they have it. Like they have no idea.
Wow.
And it's so important to know. So I used to see all those patients when I worked at UCSF in San Francisco. And there's so many people that we would give this, we would find the gene mutation and they would do a preventative oophorectomy, meaning they would preventively take out their ovaries, later. And there would be cancer that was in the ovary that would have spread. Right. And they wouldn't have known that. And that happens in BRCA patients, in Lynch patients, and a lot of these hereditary cancer syndrome patients.
That's scary.
Yeah.
That's really scary.
Anyway, going back earlier, you would ask me about BRCA in particular, like what that would look like. So what that usually looks like is when you are AFAB and you're are found to have a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, because the risk for breast cancer is so high. We do recommend two different options. So one is doing a lot of extra screening. So that's mammograms and MRIs alternating every 6 months, starting at a very young age, again, depending on family history. And the other option is having a preventative bilateral mastectomy, which some people choose to do. And some people choose to do one and then do the other later. It's a very personal decision that we talk through with people.
I would probably personally do the double mastectomy if I had that news.
Yeah, everybody's different, and then you can also do breast reconstruction with that. There's so many really interesting techniques. I work with the I just went to the Camp Breasty, which was this phenomenal camp with all these women affected by breast and gynecological cancer, and a lot of them had the preventative mastectomies, and it was just amazing to see this community. So that's something that some people will choose to do. And then there's also the ovarian cancer risk, and so when people are done having children, they'll choose to remove their ovaries and fallopian tubes. And so that is, it's really only recommended if your risk is high enough that we believe that a surgery to remove an organ is going to mitigate that risk.
Yeah.
It's not the recommendation for every gene. And we know that different genes are associated with different cancers. And so again, it depends on what the gene mutation is and to, for us to give, you know, recommendations for that. Mm-hmm. But just to give an example, like Lynch syndrome, we recommend, let's say a male has Lynch syndrome, we recommend that they do colonoscopies much earlier and more frequently than most people. So instead of every 10 years, they do it every 1 to 2 years. And that has been shown to really reduce the chance of colon cancer or catch it incredibly early. So, you know, again, depends on the gene.
Okay. That is incredible. And it's, again, the amount of preventative care that can come from this is just like, that mm-hmm. could be such a game changer for just humanity.
Yeah. Oh, and God. Then the whole fact of being able, like I said earlier, to do IVF and select embryos that don't carry that mutation, if that's what you choose to mm-hmm. do, and you can then stop that in the line, you know, you'd stop that mutation from being passed down.
So kind of bringing it back to donor conception, as a genetic counselor, what is your opinion on how the fertility industry handles medical history and a donor profile, genetic testing? How do you feel about it?
So I will say, I don't know how every single clinic does family history. I know mm-hmm. they're all a little bit different.
Yeah.
But I can tell you what I would recommend if I worked, I guess, in one of these clinics or if I were to start one. I definitely think doing a comprehensive family history with as many generations as you can get is really important. I think doing carrier screening on all the donors, like a big carrier screening, is important just to have that information.
What would be a big carrier screening? Because I think that a lot of these cryobanks, it sounds like it sounds a lot better than it is. You have a lot of these clinics and cryobanks saying that we test for 1,000 genetic mutations, 2,000, 6,000. What mm-hmm. actually is, in your professional opinion, a lot where you would go like, oh, wow, that actually is quite extensive?
So when they say 1,000 genetic mutations, I wonder if they mean points along different genes, or if they mean, I don't think they mean genes, because I don't even know what they'd be testing for. So I'm guessing they're doing SNP testing, which is kind of looking at some of the more common points on different genes that people may have, like a change that would cause disease, or mean someone's a carrier. I don't know. I think it's really hard to answer this question without kind of looking at what the average is. And I'd have to kind of get data on that. But I think, like, if a patient were to come through me, I would offer them an expanded carrier screening panel with right now there are like up to over 400 different diseases. And it's looking at all of the mutations possible for those diseases. So I don't know about those other numbers that you were just throwing out or how they're advertising what they're testing for, but I think that would be, or, you know, I'm going to rephrase this. As if I were a recipient of, let's say, donor sperm.
I'm bringing it up right now. So please keep answering the question, but I'm going to bring it up right now so that I can actually see the actual language is.
If I were, I like to put myself in my patient's shoes, and knowing what I know, what would I want? And so when I think about if I was a recipient of donor sperm, you know, what would I want the sperm to be tested for? And as somebody who wants to know everything I can, I would want them to have had a large expanded carrier screening panel with at least those, you know, 400 plus genes tested. That would give me some peace of mind. I know that that's not the norm for other genetic counselors, that they would say, oh, why do they need that? Like, as long as you get tested, but I would want to know that information. And I think I would also want them to have, so there's this minimum gene list from the American College of Medical Genetics that shows, it basically says, if you're going to have that the whole genome sequencing I talked about before, and one of these gene changes popped up, even if it had nothing to do with the reason you were testing, that it should be reported. So that's called the ACMG, like list of incidental findings that should be reported. And those are, you know, really important syndromes to know about. And I'd want any donor to have been tested for those syndromes as well. So that's not being done. I know that's not being done. I think ideally for me, if I was the patient, that's what I would want.
Yeah.
But I know that that's not always going to be doable mm-hmm. by every lab, and it may eliminate a lot of donors. So just I guess that's how I'd answer that question.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Hang on one sec. We're going to pause this right now because I have.
Okay.
Okay. So we took a quick pause to pull up a very specific video from a egg bank that I got into a little beef with on TikTok. And one of their reactions to me, because they were making a video in reaction to everything that I said.
There are institutions, groups, and individuals who spread misleading and incorrect information.
They're talking about me.
Wow. What are they saying?
And so much more. For example, did you know that during the screening process, the donors are tested for over 6,000 different genetic conditions? Or that every one of them needs...
What does that mean?
I have no idea, and I would love to know.
So as a genetic counselor, that's not correct verbiage? That's not like you don't know what...
I can't even imagine. I would love to know what panel they were talking about that they were doing. Because, I can't imagine what that would be. I would love more information. My guess is that they look at 6,000 SNPs. Or 6,000 points along a lot less genes, and that they were saying that wrong, but not 6,000 conditions. I think that somebody has mixed something up.
Okay. So let's yes and this. So let's say 6,000 SNPs.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a comprehensive amount?
It depends. No, I don't think so. It depends what genes. I don't even know what genes that would entail. What conditions that would entail. It's just by saying 6,000, even if it was 6,000 SNPs, like that doesn't give me enough information at all to understand what they're testing for.
So it sounds like lovely flowering words that really aren't actually saying anything.
Yeah, but it also sounds inaccurate. Like 6,000 conditions sounds inaccurate to me.
Fucking watching you guys. I'm watching you.
I would love to. If it truly was 6,000 conditions, I'd be incredibly interested to know what those conditions were and what that panel was, because that would be a really good comprehensive panel. But I don't know what that would be. I can't even imagine what that would be.
So this would be like groundbreaking if they tested for 6,000 genetic conditions.
Yeah. I'd want to know I want to know what that is.
Okay. I'm fucking watching you, Bank. I am watching you, and I have not forgotten you. I just want you to know that. Still got my eye on you.
If they come back to you with a list, I would love to see that list. It's possible. I have no idea what those would be or what technology they're using for that. I mean, there's no way to know that. And sometimes a lot of companies are not transparent about what they're doing. And
what? The fertility industry not being transparent? What are we talking about?
Well, a lot of the stuff you talk about when you're talking about the fertility industry and what they do, the genetic industry in general, there are fly-by-night genetic testing companies that pop up overnight and claim to do a million things. And you're like, we don't even have technology to do those things. Like, what are you talking about? But they sell because they're good at, they hire people who are good at marketing. And it's really, really difficult. And I get people all the time who like send me links and they're like, what do you think of this company? Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'll look at the company and it's like awful. Like what they're doing, they're taking like, I don't even know what they're doing with some of the samples that they're taking. I mean, it's just people, because of people's lack of understanding and knowledge about genetics,
yeah.
They're able to really prey on a lot of people and you know,
that's what I think a lot of the clinics and cryobanks do, is they really prey on the misinformation, like 6,000 genetic conditions, because that sounds like a lot. And for
it
somebody who isn't a genetic counselor, I'd be like, oh, OK, that sounds good. But I love like, you know, passing the ball to like an actual professional. And you're like, I don't think that's the thing. Like that to me is fascinating when like this kind of stuff gets talked about in any kind of world. It's just incredible. So, Dina, thank you so much for breaking down just the basics of genetic testing. This is something that, like, I now have a much better understanding of it. I hope everybody listening can, and we can start combating all of the misinformation, because it sounds like genetic testing could do so much good for us, especially if we have a better knowledge of it. So thank you for just going through all of my asinine little baby questions. So thank you so much. And our next episode is going to be really fun. We are going to be going through my medical history as I prep to get genetically tested by you, so that everybody can kind of see the process. I have already filled out the paperwork, and that will be the next episode so that everybody can see the process.
Awesome. Well, looking forward to being able to do an on-air genetic counseling session with you.
Yes, I will say for everybody else, the only difference with what I am doing versus what you'll do is yours will not be public. Yours is going to be nice and confidential. You will not be on Zoom for this. But I want everybody to sort of be prepped and ready, and so that you can see what it can do. So I am so excited. I will see you next week.
Awesome. See you then.
See you then.